Good evening, everyone. I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Do we have a recording set or request?
Yeah.
I want to begin by thanking Rebbetzin and Pratzel Pulaski and YU Connects for joining us here in B'nai Shurin for what I think is a really important conversation. I want to thank our panelists. I'm going to thank them again in just a moment when I introduce them. But we decided to have a discussion tonight about healthy relationships, navigating roles during your children's dating and marriage. The first Jewish parent in history to be involved in their children's shidduchim is none other than, in truth, the very first Jew in history. It's Avraham Avinu, who we know in Parshas Chayesara involves himself in seeking a shidduch for his son Yitzchak. And we all know the story that is recorded in Parshas Chayesara. Eliezer Eben Avraham, the servant of Avraham, goes out to find Rivka. He concocts a test. Rivka passes with flying colors. She ultimately ends up marrying Yitzchak. What we perhaps miss very often is a short prefatory note that the Torah uses before describing that whole story. The Torah begins the story by telling us, Avraham zakein bo vayamim, v'Hashem beirachas Avraham v'kol. And Avraham was advanced in age, and Hashem had blessed him with everything. And at that point, the Torah tells us, after Avraham had been blessed with everything, he sends his Eved to seek a wife for Yitzchak. There's a major debate among the Rishonim as to why exactly the Torah offers that prefatory comment, why the Torah story starts with the Torah noting that Avraham had been blessed with everything, and there are different approaches offered by Rashi and the Rashbam and the Radak. We're certainly not going to document all the different approaches tonight. But I think from a contemporary standpoint, there's something that resonates deeply with that preface of the Torah on several levels. Number one, the Torah is informing us that even Avraham Avinu, even the man who had everything, anything one can aspire for spiritually, materially, who had everything that life had to offer, he too was not exempt from the challenge of trying to find a shidduch for a child. Something that impacts us all in some way or another. We all have to face it at some point in our lives. For some people it's easier, Baruch Hashem, for others it's harder. But it's a challenge that we all face. Even those of us who are blessed b'kol, who are blessed with everything, do reach a point where we have to engage this challenge of trying to find a shidduch for our children and trying to navigate that difficult task as best we possibly can. And if even Avraham Avinu had to do so, then it perhaps offers some measure of chizuk for the rest of us as well. And secondly, it also reflects that even Avraham Avinu, who frankly had achieved everything on his own in life, Avraham Avinu initiated the greatest spiritual revolution in all of human history. Nothing about his faith was handed to him. He discovered it himself. His material wealth was achieved through his own labors. He himself was somebody who was not only successful in general material sense, he was somebody who was willing to wage war when he needed to. He was someone who was always willing to achieve everything he needed to on his own through the power of his faith and his power, the power of his own capabilities, his own God-given blessings. Here in this one instance, he realizes that it's not so simple, and he's going to need assistance from others. He marshals the assistance of, again, his Eved, of Eliezer, recognizing that this is not a problem that he can solve on his own. And I think for many parents, that's a significant challenge, recognizing that the struggles of our children at a certain point are not issues that we can solve on our own. They're issues that require outside assistance and guidance. And once again, if Avraham Avinu was willing to enlist that assistance in seeking a shidduch for his son Yitzchak, then certainly we, who perhaps are not on the immense, who have not attained the great heights of Avraham Avinu, we should not be ashamed to be willing to seek assistance, guidance, and help as well. And that's largely the reason why we put together this event, navigating the shidduch world and the world of having children who are married, the early stages of marriage, or perhaps even more advanced stages of marriage, is not an easy thing to navigate. And we brought with us together, Baruch Hashem, a panel of really fantastic individuals who will help guide us in that endeavor. Now, before I introduce our panelists, I want to ask Rebbetzin Sobolovsky to please take the podium for a moment and just to offer some brief words of introduction as well, and then we will introduce our panelists and hopefully get into the heart of our program.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Schreier. Thank you all for coming. I know it's not simple to get out at night, so really appreciate that everyone came out. I just wanted to take 2 minutes to thank the people who helped organize tonight. First of all, B'nai Shurin for hosting. They're always so gracious about these panels and make it very easy for us. The Rockwells, the Pipers, the Tigers, and the Weinsteins and the Orlitskis helped us plan this particular evening, so I wanted to give a shout out to all of them and really thank you for that. This type of event, this educational panel, actually tonight there's another panel at the same time simultaneously at Stern with the Shalom Task Force for the Women, but these types of panels is one of the missions parts of Y Connects that we do. In addition to setting people up and matchmaking and databases and social events, one of our very important features, I would say one of the missions that we work really hard at, is to do education, not just to set people up, but to really try to create healthy relationships. So as part of that, this is one of the panels. And it was very exciting when we sent out the email. All of these questions that have come up are all from all of you. We didn't make any of them up. Not only did I not make any of them up, but I didn't even discuss with them what they're going to answer. So it's going to be very much whatever you hear. So I'm sure they're wonderful. But it's a range, like Rabbi Schreier said, from beginning of dating to early marriage. I also just want to say now that we're in Bergen County. I know there's some people who came outside of Bergen County, but I do want to say that we should be very proud in Bergen County that everyone has become involved and helpful in helping people meet. So I want to just give a shout out to a bunch of things that are going out, initiatives that Y Connects is doing and other parts of TNEC that are doing. So first of all, Chaya Schwartz and Aviva Edelstein have been tremendous in creating Project Meet a Match, which meets here once a month. And we have a website, we have a chat that buzz all day long, featuring people who want to be set up, and they have once a month meetings, which is wonderful because all the shuls have representation and they come here once a month to meet, and they've had many dates, but even I think close to 10 marriages from the whole last few years since COVID when we started that. More, we also started a few, I would say 3 months ago, I just want to give a shout out to Rabbi Jason Finkelstein and Rabbi Andrew Israeli and Rabbi Jed Zassel, who's not here, who we hired to do one evening a week at YU to meet new men in the base membership and try to set them up with the women that come our way. So just Jed and Andrew stand up. They're both very busy people and they're juggling a few jobs, so if they leave earlier, it's because they have other nights they have commitments, but tonight's not the night that they're supposed to be at YU, so that's why they're here. And they're ready, you know, dates all day long. They're working with people in this community. They're working with the shachanim that we have. So I wanted to know. The podcast, thanks to the donors and the supporters of the podcast, is doing beautifully. And we have Randy Wartelski here, who's one of our amazing hosts. And one of the episodes came out today that was Randy. But that's an example, again, of these educational panels on very easy. You could listen while you exercise, while you walk. And I think that every single episode has great tips that we're learning from. Even today's one that Connie Jurabell spoke about, I learned a whole bunch of new skills. So you should just know like that. What else can I say? And in addition to the database, I just want you to note that Mindy and Malky Gallagher and Naomi Lansman and the other 100 volunteer connectors really spent a lot of time getting to know as many members as they can. Not just on the database, they meet in person, they meet in Zoom. They're booked for weeks to meet people on Zoom, 15 minutes at a time, and then they really set people up. We have Naomi Lansman, who's the regional connector, and she really volunteers her time to come and to meet with them once a week. And I just want to thank the husbands of all these wives. Everybody knows when you get involved and should know when your spouse has to tolerate all the time that you're involved in this too. So I have to say that. Without further ado, I'm going to let Rabbi Schreier briefly introduce, and then we're going to get right into the questions.
Okay, I'm going to start speaking before I have the microphone. We're going to try to get it working. I'm going to take the liberty also of sitting down at this point. Thank you, Ari. And I'm just going to briefly introduce our panelists. So sitting immediately to my right is Rabbi Ari Leibowitz Shlita. He is the director of Smicha at Reitz, as well as the Marda Asra of Beis HaKnesses of North Woodmere. He was previously a Rebbe at Landers College for Men, an 11th grade Rebbe at DRS Yeshiva High School, which I had the privilege of attending, and of course, an amazing Marbitz Torah and Torah leader in our time. That is Rabbi Ari Leibowitz. Sitting two seats down from Rabbi Leibowitz is Professor Naomi Nehama Clapper. She is a licensed psychotherapist. She maintains a private practice in Manhattan. Her practice includes individual therapy, premarital counseling, couples counseling, and family therapy. And she is also currently the chair of the Department of Psychology at Lander College. Thank you for joining us, Professor Clapper. And then all the way to the right is Mindy Eisenman. She is the staff connector or matchmaker and dating coach at YU Connects. She is speaking with and meeting daters every day and making matches while she holds a master's degree in social work from Wurzweiler. She is also a Tanakh and Torah Mishpacha educator. She's also a certified Shalom workshop instructor. Mindy already has, get this, more than 60 engagements. More than 60 engagements. And is known for guiding members or advising new connectors on best practices. Mindy, thank you for joining us as well. So we're going to have, like I said at the outset, and as Rebbe Sobolovsky highlighted as well, we're going to really focus on two different things. First is navigating the dating world, and really Rebbe Sobolovsky is going to guide that conversation. And then at a certain point, we will transition to talking about parental involvement in young married children's lives, and at that point, I will guide much of the conversation. So without further ado, Rebbe Sobolovsky. We'll get that one working too. Take this one.
Okay, question number one. What discussions should I have with my son or daughter who's dating? How do I get involved and find out their expectations of me and my role in the process? And can I share some of my expectations of the plan for dating or early marriage with my upcoming date? We'll start with Rabbi Leibowitz.
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, it's an honor to be here with you this evening, Rishus the Merda Asra, and my fellow panelists over here. As far as discussions with your children when they start dating, I think the most important thing is that it should not be the first discussion you ever have with your children, meaning it should be built on years and years and years of developing a trusting, loving relationship with our children, and this should be a natural outgrowth that if they're dealing with something that is the most important decision they're ever going to make in their lives, that naturally they're going to want to hear their parents' opinion, their parents who love them, who care for them, who always have their best interests in mind. Meaning oftentimes, a Talmud will say, I'm dealing with an issue, in dating, I don't know about this issue, that issue, and I'll often ask the Talmud, what do your parents think? And the response from the Talmud to that question is a very telling thing. Sometimes I get a look like, who cares what my parents think? And sometimes I'll get a very detailed answer. Oh, I spoke the zone with my parents, and this is their opinion, and it tells you a lot about that relationship. Now, I will also tell you that if there is something that you can't live with, some hakpada that you have, some hang-up that you have, and your child is in shidduch, where you get to say yes or no at the beginning, do not wait until they've been dating for 3 or 4 months and then say, you know what, you shouldn't marry a teacher, you know, or something like that. Again, that's just the example that came up. Don't get me started on that, but that's just the example that actually came up. Someone broke up a shidduch because they knew that the person was going to be a teacher, but they allowed it to go forward, and the couple was getting along very, very nicely. That should be things like that. Hopefully nothing like that, but whatever hakpadas there are, whatever you can't live with, should be dealt with when it can be, if you're in shidduchim, at the very beginning. When it comes to financial expectations, things of that nature, again, it just spell it out. When I was a Rebbe in Lander College, the Mashkiach there, the Moshe Vandenberg, is a dear friend of mine, and I remember, we used to sit next to each other during morning Seder, and boys would often come and ask, am I ready to start dating? They'll ask the Rebbe, do you think I'm ready to start dating? And he would sit them down, and he would say, okay, here's what it costs to be married. And he would just go through, this is what an apartment costs, this is what an electric bill looks like, this is what, so like Aleph is like, can you actually live? Like, you're gonna commit yourself to a ksuba. Rav Asher Weiss often quotes his mother, that she used to say, I know why they write the ksuba in Aramaic, because they think the women won't understand it then. But I know what it says. I know that it means that you're obligated to support me. So that's an obligation, and it is. It should be spelled out. Now, obviously, many times there's a lot of help coming from a number of different directions, and if you're willing and able to offer that help, that is beautiful and wonderful. It should all be spelled out. So I think all of those are expectations and conversations that can be had.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What do I say to my daughter, or son, I should say, when she has had, not had any suggestions in a long time, in months, a situation that amplifies the disappointment when she finally has a date, and then it doesn't work?
Good evening. So I feel that this is a time when a lot of people's personal anxieties become projected and exaggerate what's going on with their children. I realize that this is a very scary process for a lot of people. It's a very out of control feeling for young people, and it's a very out of control feeling for a variety of reasons, especially for the women, which is too long a tangent to go into right now. And a very out of control feeling for the parents. Sometimes the first time they feel out of control in their child's life. And you don't want to exacerbate this, and you don't want to feed your, you know, project your anxieties onto them and make a difficult process already harder. An open mindset about, you know, it being an exciting chapter, an open mindset about being more open minded is very important. There are a lot of amazing initiatives that communities are doing that young people are not taking advantage of, either because they're getting guidance from friends, which don't even get me started there, or they're not really in an open-minded mindset. They're in a more rigid mindset. It's, you know, pasnished, or my friends aren't doing it. But there are amazing initiatives, and encouraging them to try something new, like Albert Einstein said, the definition of insanity is trying to think the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So encouraging them to try something new, not even for the outcomes, because sometimes when we just feel a little more empowered, we bring a different energy to the table. So if we're trying something, even if we don't think, quote, our type of person is there, we feel more empowered, and then we bring that energy into an experience. And initiatives, someone told me that they're building in Deal, for example, this JCC type place, arena, but it's just for young people to meet. And they were lamenting, like, it's such a shame we're going to have a restaurant and speakers and activities, but my child, she's not going to go there. So, you know, encouraging people to sort of go out of their comfort zone. Marriage is the ultimate going out of your comfort zone. And it's a great learning opportunity to also encourage people to, you know, just be a little more open-minded, a little more flexible and try new things, because it'll also help them feel a little more empowered at a time where they might be feeling helpless or stuck.
Yeah, is that okay? I'm short, I'm sorry. First, I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. It's so nice to see so many familiar faces and so many new faces. I should stand. The fact that you're here shows what wonderful parents you are, so Kala Kavod. There is nothing more difficult than seeing our children in pain. So it is very important when your child has not had a date in a long time and they're starting to feel a little bit down to validate how they feel. It's very important for them to feel that you are on their side. But as good parents, we have hopefully been teaching our children since they're little that life is not just smooth and easy, right? Sometimes they don't get the part in the play. Sometimes they don't get to sit next to the person they want to. They don't get into the bunk they want to in camp. And we teach them resilience, slowly, subliminally, that this is okay. We don't get everything we want, and we still have to make the best of it. Here, too, it's important to normalize the situation. It's okay that you don't always get dates. You're looking for the right date. You don't need date after date. As a matter of fact, statistically, it is proven that just because someone gets a lot of dates doesn't mean that they get married sooner. Really, we're looking for the right person. So whether your child goes out a lot or not so often, it's okay. We need to recognize that Hashem has a plan. So validate, teach your child resilience. Perhaps recognize that Hashem has a plan, and therefore do something. Maybe take your child on a little vacation, or give your child some different opportunities to do different kinds of chesed in the neighborhood so that they feel that they have meaning in their life. Because if they are in a good place, if they have a good mindset. So when the right person comes into their path, when Hashem sends that person, they will be ready and they will be able. But if they're feeling down and they're feeling bitter, even if the right one comes along, it won't work. Be open to trying new ideas. And timing is everything. Just recently, a mom told me that she tells her kids all the time, she went out with her husband twice, and she actually thought he was too nice, so she didn't want to go out with him again. But then, later on, someone suggested that she revisit it, and then the timing was right. 6 weeks later, they were engaged. Just so happens, that was the story. So timing is everything. Thank you. Next. Sarah.
Okay, what is the suggested age difference for a healthy marriage, if there is? I don't even know. How long, how many dates is it when you should decide it's sick?
So, there's a joke about if you ask this therapist a question, I'll start with, it depends. It depends, you know, that's the joke. But it's really true here that it really depends. We seem like a homogeneous group from the outside, but we are really a very heterogeneous group with very different norms. In the Hasidic community, for example, the norm is for there to be very little age difference. 18-year-olds marrying 18-year-olds. And interestingly, they have a much lower statistics of too many girls than other communities, which is its own discussion about why that is. But in other communities, it's a much more acceptable thing to have a very large age difference in certain places. In certain Sephardic communities, for example, the Sunni community, a big age difference is very acceptable. One of the things I can tell you is that when you look at an age difference, you're really looking at if there's a difference in power or voice, if the relationship feels equal, if they respect each other and they feel like there's an equal voice and an equal balance, then an age difference shouldn't be a difference, a problem. Obviously, as parents, you're all thinking the same thing. You know, age and maturity don't necessarily correlate. You have 19-year-olds who are turning 26, and 26-year-old men who are going on 19. So it's not necessarily about the age, it's about the actual maturity itself.
Marriage is about life. It's not just about going for coffee and mini golf and dinner. So it's important at a certain point for dating to reflect that as well. So you need to date long enough that you see people in their normal life setting. For instance, right now I tell people to go and pick out Mother's Day cards. You're welcome. Pick up dry cleaning, hang out at each other's homes so that parents get to know them in a very natural setting. People can only hide their true selves for so long. And after a while, when you see how the other person treats your child and how your child smiles when they're around that person, how they handle themselves in different kinds of situations, then you know it's been the right time.
We'll talk about how long to date. I feel like I'm not Stacy then. What's an appropriate amount of time to date somebody? Getting engaged is a relationship-based decision. It's not a race to the finish line. It's really a relationship-based decision. The research shows that certain personalities have love styles that match those personalities more. Some are more deliberate, and they're sort of slow and steady wins the race, and they need more time for affection to grow. And other people are much more in touch with their feelings. They're much more in touch with themselves, and they trust their guts much more, and they're able to move more quickly. One of the things that's interesting if we look at trends is that in communities where the dating used to be very short duration, Hasidic community, Shiva community, the Achrayas deciding if the child was, this person who was dating your child, rather, was worthy, was also shared with the parents. Honestly, in some communities, once, the Achrayas was squarely on the shoulders of the parents. And what we see in the trend now, in our community, where we still have a more modern view that the young men and women are deciding for themselves, and they're really the people who are in it and who know if this person feels right for them, they're borrowing some of the trends of those more yeshivish communities where they want to be faster and they, you know, sort of speed along, date and certainly marry younger, but without taking the full package, where those communities have a lot of guidance and a lot of involvement from the parents. So we can see as parents why that may be sort of paradoxical and make us a little nervous. We are most influenced by the people we are closest to. So if you can hold on to a really close relationship with your child, you are most likely to be able to give them the guidance that they need during this time. You can no longer, you know, just threaten your badger that doesn't work. They'll just shut down. And people always lament to me that, oh, their children listen to their rabbis or their rebbetzins over their parents, and their parents know them best. Who knows them better than their parents? I agree with you, I'm a parent. But if you can maintain a relationship with them, that is your currency for influence. And they're much more likely to really want to be makabel what you want to share with them.
Okay. This is one I'll answer just because it's a quick one. Somebody asked about J-screen. And J-screen is one of the options for genetic compatibility, meaning genetic testing. I should say there's Doria Sharm and there's J-screen. Doria Sharm is the closed testing. Many of the schools do it in 12th grade. And many of our young men and women are tested. Their blood is tested in 12th grade and then we have those results. But some people in the YU world are also doing J-screen, my kids did both. And that's an open testing where it's a saliva test and you order it on jscreen.org. And the coupon code that I like to give everybody is jscreen50 in case your child didn't do it and you want them to do it. jscreen50 gives you $50 off and it's the reprogen test where they just spit in a cup and then 3 weeks later, they get the results of what they're a carrier for, if anything. And then sometimes, you know, when they're dating someone, they compare it to the other person that they're dating. The reason the person asked the question is they were saying that their daughter is in their late 20s, and they're finding that many of the men that she's dating never went for the testing. So I just think we all just have to remember, as a responsible parent, that when whoever your son or your daughter starts to date, have one of these things done, because it does take time. Meaning even when you get tested, it takes a month for you to get the results. And so many times we're dealing with people that are almost engaged and then it's like, oops, no one went for testing. And then there's another month of hold off and nerves because somebody's being tested for what the other person is a carrier for. So if you want to do Doria Sharm, do Doria Sharm. If you want to do J-screen, jscreen.org. It takes literally 5 minutes to fill out the form. Do JScreen50 when it asks you for a discount code. Write YUConnect, and it's mailed to your house, and your child does it, and then puts it right back in the mail. Okay. Next question. At what point would it be appropriate for us as parents to look into the person our child is dating or starting to date? Also, what are the questions we should be looking for to have answers?
This is obviously a discussion that you should be having with your child before they start dating. How involved they want you in this relationship depends on what kind of relationship you have with them. You should never do anything to jeopardize your relationship with your child. As to what questions to ask, so again, this is a discussion with your child as to values. Right, just because you have a value and something is important to you, sort of like what Rabbi Leibowitz said, maybe your child is thrilled to marry a certain profession and you're not happy with that, but you have to, at a certain point, just like we give our kids roots, we give them wings and recognize that this is their life, and we're trying to help them look for a life partner for them. So if this is something that they want and a value that matters to them, so these are questions that you have to ask. If they want someone who's very chesed oriented, so that's the type of question that you would be asking. You should look for consistency when you ask questions. See if you hear the same thing over and over again. Chances are, if you hear something a lot, it's true. We also don't have a specific scripted way of dating. in the modern Orthodox world. So really, if your child wants you to make calls, you can make one or two phone calls, and then, you know, you want to see, is it going to go anywhere? After 4 or 5 dates, which is usually like 2 or 3 weeks, so it's not like they are, oh my goodness, you know, head over heels, crazy in love. Then if you want, if you were having trouble reaching perhaps a busy rabbi or a busy teacher or someone overseas, you can also double down and, you know, ask more questions then as well.
Okay, I'm just going to switch the order because I feel disrespectful. It's really the Lord. It's really disrespectful. I'm married to my husband. I'm not. Okay, I'm just going to switch two questions over. Okay. What do you feel, Rabbi Leibowitz, the most important quality that we should be looking for in a potential spouse?
Okay. It's not disrespectful at all. I'm learning a lot. I took my Talmidim yesterday to Yeshiva Torah Vadas to meet with Rabbi Yisrael Reisman. And it was a question-answer session about a lot of different things. And at the end, he just said, he realized a lot of the boys are married. He said, when you come home tonight and every night, and your wife asks, how was your day today? Say, it was great. It was excellent. And put a big smile on your face. Later on, you could say, oh, by the way, we need a new car because someone smashed into it. I mean, like the positivity that a happy home makes for a happy life, and the sense of positivity of being easygoing, rolling with the punches, someone who's just someone that you're happy to be around, I think is probably the most important thing. I cannot tell you how many times I get questions from Talmidim about can I go out with a girl or get engaged to a girl or marry a girl who has, and then they like identify the most minute, tiny detail. I said, well, if that's all I know about her, how could you possibly make a decision based on that? Meaning people are made up of like millions and millions of factors about them, and they're complicated. So to narrow it down to like one little thing, but if we had to narrow it down, I would think just being a positive, happy person. You know, I've often told my Talmidim, having no idea if I'm correct. By the way, on all of this, I have no idea if I'm correct. The experts are all sitting to my right, and I don't know why I'm here, but it's never shy to talk. For years, I've been telling my Talmidim that much, much more important than hashkafa is how well you get along, how happy you are to be around the person, how anxious you feel or relaxed you feel when you are around that person. And I felt very vindicated because I just heard an interview with Rabbi Dr. Danishevsky, and he quoted Dr. Gottman, who's a world-renowned marriage expert. I think he's been married 3 times, so he should be an expert in that. And Dr. Gottman had said that he became famous by being able to watch a couple interact for a short period of time and be able to predict with alarming accuracy whether they would be divorced in 5 years, going forward 5 years. And he said that the only factor that matters is how you feel when you're around that person. It's how you feel about yourself, how you feel when you're around that person. Are you happy? Are you comfortable? I was once interviewed on a podcast. I was not on the YU Connects podcast. I was interviewed on the YU Connects podcast, but this was from a different interview. And someone asked like the classic question of, if you could talk to anyone in history for an hour and you know, just have a conversation with them, who would it be? And people say like I don't know, David HaMelech or Albert Einstein or whatever, I don't know. So I said, my wife, I would just want to hang out, be at home, you know, schmoozing with my wife. And everyone said to me afterwards, that is so romantic. And I'm like, no, that's not what I was thinking. I wasn't trying to be romantic. What I was trying to say was, I'm an introvert. I know it doesn't come out in public settings, but I'm an introvert. I don't love socializing and going. I get very nervous around big people. The fact that Rabbi Sobolevsky is in the room and that my lips are moving is a Kiddush. I get very, very nervous around big people. And I just rather be comfortable. And I think that's a very, very important quality. I see way too often that people aren't even looking for that quality at all.
Okay.
Thank you.
No problem.
I was asked to say, just to share that there was a study done by the OU a number of years ago, and they followed 40,000 respondents. I can't even remember how many they sent out, but anyone who's done research knows it was definitely more than 4,000. And they asked people when they were engaged, out of 36 characteristics, what are the 5 top ones that they look for in a spouse? And then they followed up with them 5 years later, and they asked them again, out of 36 characteristics, now that you've been in the trench of marriage for 5 years, what are your top characteristics? And not surprisingly, many of the respondents had very different characteristics, things that they had looked when they were dating and that even attracted them to their partner were not things that they put in the trench of 2 careers and juggling toddlers and all of life. Things that seemed a little bit boring and vanilla, like maturity, reliability, emotional stability, are things that really came to light that they appreciated if their partner had them and sorely missed if their partners didn't have them. And it makes us think when we're talking to our young people as people that can guide them from being more experienced than they are, that if we can encourage them to think about their life in 5 years from when they start to be married and live life back, to try and imagine what that would be like. Because the things that they're looking for now, someone spontaneous and fun-loving, really goes into that category of wants as opposed to needs. And I know there's been a lot of discussion of wants versus needs. But it is really very important, I found when you talk to young people, you end up feeling like they're almost in a Build-A-Bear project. You know, it's like, build a wife, let's get some mechalah on her, blonde hair, you know, they get very into their, like, specific criteria. And they really kind of forget the qualities that we really thought we had taught them about, you know, empathetic, and the ability to give altruistically and not be selfish, and frustration tolerance, the things that you thought you had like put into their heads that somehow flew out of their heads once they started dating. So I do think it's an opportunity, again, to try and encourage them to really think about life a little bit further down the pipeline and look backwards. Not like, did you have fun? Where did you go? But really to ask the deeper questions that help them think. Questions about their empathy, how can you tell they're kind, and honestly, it really is our job to give them those tools, because like I said, we're not holding on to the achrayas squarely on our shoulders to pick those people, but to teach them how to tell the character and integrity behind the person they're dating. They're going out with this person with their smiling face and a perfectly selected outfit and their blow-dried hair. And those are the guys that I'm describing, by the way. And then you're saying, like, tell me if they're kind. Tell me if they're empathetic. Tell me what their frustration tolerance is like. And I'm like, I don't know. We went mini golfing. So the tools that you want to give them is the tools of how you can really tell, because the serendipitous moments are really how they can tell. And if you want to know what dating coaching does, a lot of the time is they're teaching them those tools of how to tell in those serendipitous moments what a person is really like in their innermost qualities. Okay. It's such an important question, and I think it is very telling that there are 3 people answering it with 3 different answers, each one I think being worthwhile. So I think that each answer will speak to different people. I actually like both answers. I wrote something different. I actually couldn't come up with one. I gave myself the liberty of selecting 3. I have flexibility, kindness, and chesed oriented. And it happens to be that as we're coming closer to Shavuot, so Rabbi Yonatan Grossman gave a shiur in Israel, and I will not give you all the details, but he basically found 9 similarities between the story of Eliezer searching for Rivka and the story of Boaz and Ruth. And in both of them, he proves through the Sukkim, through the Pshat, that Hashem is definitely the matchmaker. Hashem, through Hashkacha, Hashem places Rivka where she's supposed to be and Boaz where he is supposed to be. But it's only because of their chesed and their altruistic kindness and their ability to act a certain way depending on the situation that actually made the matches go through.
Okay, we're going to ask one more dating question, and then I'm giving it to Rabbi Schreier, because I don't want to be disrespectful to Rabbi Schreier. For real. Okay, because it's like we're very women heavy. Okay. Dr. Klauber, Professor Klauber, this one is more for you. How do you stick to your own beliefs when faced with a question whether to continue dating someone or not? There's so many opinions, and my son or daughter is going to speak to so many different people. How do you know what is true, and how to listen to your own voice?
Thank you. It's a great question. So it depends who all these opinions are. Like, who is this committee that they're going to, you know, and what are their concerns? Are these other people married, people who have a lot of wisdom and insight, and are noticing red flags, really, that are different than what you picked up from your, you know, character flaws or traits that you're not seeing? That's very different than friends who are not married, who share their wisdom of, well, I just don't see it after meeting him or her, you know, which people get a lot. I think for the vast majority of people, a lot of opinions are just very confusing, right? We don't want a committee vote here. We're not harvesting ballots. It's just too confusing. This isn't an Olympic sport where your son or daughter is looking for the best guy or the best girl out there, and you have this committee of friends and family members and siblings sort of like with like votes on the committee saying 10, you know, 9.3, deducted points for technicality, he didn't have a Torah when he came for Shabbos. You know, you really don't want this feeling of a committee. And I know that our norms in our community are to get a lot of people invited, involved at the very beginning because of the references. That is just the norms of our community. And I have to tell you that I think that the Mossad would definitely envy some of the dossiers that people have here of data that they have collected with mugshots and fingerprints. It's just quite remarkable what a little motivation can do. But remember that all those references, they know them in one capacity only. I have been teaching on the college level for decades. I know my students well in one capacity, right? Maybe I know how they handle a test that they're disappointed in, but that's still one capacity. And I find a lot of times that by the time a young person has sat and spoken one-on-one to people for many hours on a date, they could also be a knowledgeable reference about that person. They also have knowledgeable data, sometimes more knowledgeable than the rabbi or the parent's friend, because they've seen him in a totally different capacity. So I'm going to ask the young person who asked this question about their voice versus the opinions of other people. There are two possible scenarios here. One scenario is that they're dating someone and they have a real uh-oh feeling about this person. Like a really gut-wrenching, nervous feeling about if they could trust them, if they're really who they present to be. And everyone else is reassuring them, oh, I've heard amazing things, right? So in that kind of case, I always tell the person, you're a living with them, right? This is the person that you would be with. I mean, this is your life. You have to listen to your own voice in that case. All these people who know them, they don't know them in the capacity that you know them. So you listen to your own voice. But if it's a scenario, which happens very often, that you feel that your uh-oh feeling is born of anxiety, right? That you tend to be an overthinker, you tend to be a worrier, you tend to be someone who, you know, wants to make a decision, goes back and revisits it over and over again, then I do think it helps to have a selah harav, an experienced married person in a marriage that you admire and are really stressing married, because then you can use them as a sounding board. But again, a selah harav, not a whole Sanhedrin. You know, they said they have so many opinions, right? You don't need a jury here. Just one married person. Why married and not single? I find that in every other area of our life, we're so used to getting expert opinion, right? You wouldn't go to your accountant, and while you're there, say, excuse me, how does this mole look? Does it look suspicious? Like, you know, you go to a dermatologist. We get expert advice on everything. And yet, when it comes to dating relationships, a lot of young people, who do they ask? Who do they go to? Their friends, right? Single friends. So if you were going on an interview to your dream job, would you ask
an unemployed person, how should I prepare, how should I dress? And maybe that unemployed person would actually give you a lot of good advice and some bad advice. And sometimes these single friends do give some good advice, but trust me, sometimes they give the worst advice. And you really want to get an expert, someone who you have insight and a connection to and has your best interest in heart. Sometimes when people are dating, this also unfortunately becomes sort of a tug of war between what the quality of the young person wants and what they feel their parents feel that they should want. And sometimes an impartial person can also untangle that as well, a wise minded person, and see what the parents' concerns come from, where they're you know, valid, and helps them sort of smooth that and connect that as well.
Okay, so we're going to move into, I guess, a new realm for a few minutes for our remaining time, pertaining to being parents of young married couples, or at least primarily. And here I'll emphasize that I'll pose the questions primarily as a voice for all of you who submitted questions, but also as a rav, as a pastoral and communal rabbi who sees a lot of issues that sometimes emerge in the relationship between parents and young married children. And we're just going to ask our panelists their advice on how to navigate some of those scenarios. And the first question I want to ask is actually, I'd say, not really narrowly fitting into the category I just described. We'll call it a pre-married children question. And it kind of dovetails on what Professor Clapper was actually discussing just a moment ago. What happens in scenarios where the parents are not the experts that a child consults, and your child is very seriously dating and is perhaps ready to get engaged or ready to marry someone who you didn't really envision for them, not the person that you thought your child was going to marry? And part of you feels conflicted. On the one hand, you want to perhaps steer your child in a different direction. On the other hand, you know that this other individual who they are seriously dating and, you know, and considering marrying is likely going to be a part of your family, or at least potentially going to be a part of your family in the future. How does a parent properly navigate that balance in terms of trying to steer their child in the right direction while also respecting their choices?
I don't know. I only have one married child, and my daughter-in-law is awesome. Leah and Hara. So I don't really... By the way, I also know a great dermatologist. I would say that if a person finds themselves thinking that it looks like my child is about to get engaged to someone that I didn't envision for them, it's a good idea to sit down with your spouse and talk about why it is that you feel that way. Meaning, it may be a you thing and not a them thing. Why do I feel that this is not what I envisioned? There are people that only envision, you know, a shidduch from a prominent family or from whatever their hang-ups may be. And really ask yourself, is whatever my hang-up is it real? Is it a genuine concern? And do like lots of bidikos v'chakiros to make sure that this is actually something that matters and that's a genuine concern. And then, again, I look forward to the answers from the other panelists, but and then when you have this conversation with your child, do not say anything negative. Figure out the most positive ways to express your concern. Do not say anything negative about the other party. It will come back to haunt you. It will always come back to haunt you. Do not say anything negative about the other person. You can talk about compatibility or whatever, but one has to be very, very... Words are powerful, so just one has to be very, very careful in how they express themselves. But I look forward to the real answers.
First, I thought that was a great answer. Okay. First of all, I thought that was a great answer. Secondly, I want to just say that your children are navigating a very difficult situation in that time, because most children really want to please their parents. They want their parents to be happy for them. They dream of their parents and their future spouse being close and having a great relationship. And this is a very difficult thing for them to toggle. And the best gift that you could give them is to get along with their partner. Your personal preferences are
not important. They just, if they're really going to marry that person, then the best thing you can do is get close to that person and become that person's best friend. First of all, if you have concerns that you think you can help them grow and develop in, and again, like I said, the research shows we are most influenced by the people that they're closest to. And I can't begin to tell you how many times someone has come to me truly shredded, like really distraught about the partner that their child has chosen. And then it turns out to be their favorite daughter-in-law or son-in-law. Right? The jury's not yet in. If you've raised your child, you have to trust them that there's something that they're seeing in them. Obviously, you're going to have one or two or 100 conversations with them about, you know, why this is their choice and you know, and share with them also some tools that you think might help. But if you think that there's something of concern about that partner and how they navigate it, but your relationship with their child and that child's parents is really the greatest gift you can give your kids. It just helps their own shalom bias, and it models for them also the shalom bias that they need one day in their own relationship with that person.
If I can be so bold, I'll just add one additional thought. And if Rabbi Leibowitz prefaced his remarks by saying that he only has one married child, I will preface my remarks by saying that my oldest son is 7 years old. So, Professor Klapper, I am the unemployed preaching job advice to the crowd. But one thing I will say in many of these conversations, and this largely overlaps with something Rabbi Leibowitz was mentioning before, is really what is your level of concern when you find a partner that you don't deem to be the partner that you envisioned? On several occasions, I've had conversations with parents precisely in this scenario. And the first question I always ask is this person going to treat your child well? Are they going to treat your daughter well? Are they going to treat your son well? And the answer to that question will largely determine how the rest of the conversation goes. If the answer is no, then we're dealing with one kind of situation. If you're really concerned about the well-being of your child and you really don't think they're going to treat your child well, then we have one category of conversation. If the answer is yes, frequently that really often reframes the issues that parents have. Lots of times they didn't even really bother to think about that first question. And once they do, they realize that perhaps some of the other issues that they're considering or thinking about are not as necessarily significant as they initially felt. So I do think it's very important, as Rabbi Leibowitz was saying, to identify what kinds of issues you're dealing with. If they're grave issues pertaining to the health and well-being of your child, then that's one conversation. If it's other things pertaining to what you wanted because you wanted a certain caliber of Torah at the table or a certain sleep length or whatever the case may be, then perhaps it's a different character of conversation entirely. Let's move to a scenario where the children are now married. There has been a well-documented rise in the rate of early divorces, perhaps even Shana Rishona divorces, and frequently there's concern on part of parents about the health of their children's relationship. How do parents navigate scenarios where, let's say, they seem to, as a parent, I seem to identify what appears to me to be an unhealthy dynamic within my child's spousal relationship, and I want to help on the one hand, and perhaps guide them on the one hand, but also maintain proper boundaries on the other. I want to make sure that they are set up for a long and happy and healthy marriage rather than one that is unfortunately doomed to fail. What can parents do or not do in order to maintain that proper balance and guide their children in the right direction?
That was more than one question, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, as far as the elevated divorce rate, which is, you know, even an inanimate object, the Mizbeach is Mori Demalos over something like that. And it's certainly something that's extremely, extremely painful. It really ties into a lot of the things that that Dr. Klapper and that Mindy and that Rabbi Shrey, that everyone's been talking about. I have a close friend who is a divorce lawyer, and he told me that many divorces happen, at least when the client presents themselves, they say, because my spouse made me choose between them or my family. And it talks a lot to the how helpful it could be when you work hard at developing a positive relationship with the child-in-law, even if it's not what you always envisioned or whatever else, and how hurtful it can be when that relationship isn't there. I do also suggest to everybody, to every single chassan that I teach, that they should take advantage of the time that they're engaged to go for some pre-marriage work. There are wonderful therapists, social workers, people who have developed curriculum for young couples to learn basic skills and how to navigate when there's a fight about where to go for yativ, how to navigate pressures and finances, how to navigate all the, there are basically five issues that come up at the beginning of every marriage, and just how to navigate those basic issues that are not fiducian, but to that couple, it feels like they're the only ones in the world that are going through that. And I always tell the chassan that there are three benefits to having this experience, to being able to go together with your kala for pre-marriage and a little post-marriage. I suggest a few meetings before and a few meetings after. And it's a worthwhile investment. Yeah, therapists cost a lot of money, but you know, divorces cost more. It's a very, very worthwhile investment. I tell them that there are three advantages. Advantage number one is you might actually learn something, which is, you know, the most obvious. But probably the least important of the three, actually. Advantage number two is that just the fact that you and your kala are going to carve out time where you're going to go together and spend time just to work on your relationship and to make sure your relationship is as good as it could be, that itself, just that statement, that silent statement of going together, that itself is the greatest relationship builder. I'll tell you, one chassan came to me afterwards, and he said, you know, Rebbe, when you were saying that thing about pre-marriage, we call it workshops, because Shalom Tashmash came up with the word workshop, because the word therapy scares people, so, you know, or makes it sound like something's wrong, and I suggest this even if nothing is wrong. A chassan said to me, when you were talking about that, I was thinking in my mind the whole time, there is no way on God's green earth that I am going to do that. And then I mentioned it as a joke to my kala that night, and she's like, oh, we're doing that. And he said, and I'll tell you, after having gone to our first session, I never felt closer to my kala in my life, you know, in our entire relationship, than after having gone to that first session. So that's advantage number two. Advantage number three is, and I'm sure Bishwari can speak to this also, that very often, by the time a couple that is having some trouble reaches out, it is too late. Not to say that it's necessarily too late, but often they've let things spiral out of control well beyond where it should have gone. And it takes a lot to reach out to someone. But if you already have a relationship with someone, you know, oh, that's the person we go to when we have an issue in the relationship, it doesn't take that much. Then it's like, okay, we're really fighting over where to spend yontif this, you know, for a young couple, that's like a big deal. We're really fighting about where to, why don't we just consult our person and talk about how to navigate having this conversation and how to navigate getting through this issue together. And that to me is a huge advantage. I'll tell you, I have just one more story. I had a mother of a chassan call me. And she said, I don't want my son to know that I'm calling you, which is often the first line of the I don't want my son to know that I'm calling you. He really needs to go for pre-marriage, you know, counseling, workshop. He really, the kala that he found is a gem. She's a tzadekes. He can't mess this up. I really don't want, it was nice, refreshing to hear. She was so, a little more confidence in her son, maybe, but no. But I just don't want him to mess this up. And I said, I recommend that for everybody. She's like, oh, thank God. I don't want him to feel like he's being singled out either. And so I think getting ahead of the game a little bit, you know, is often a better solution than the troubleshooting. As far as parent meddling and how much meddling should be done and how much getting involved, I have a good friend whose father is a very good therapist on the Upper West Side, and he told me when he got married, his father always said, I keep my mouth shut and my wallet open. And that's, you know, we may hurt for us to say that or to think that. It is, it's worthwhile. Whatever it costs, I mean, your children pay you back so much more. They give you grandchildren. I mean, that's like, whatever you give your kids, it's not as good as a grandkid, right? I mean, it's worth it. Mouth shut, wallet open, good policy.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I hear two questions going to come in simultaneously. Rabbi Schreier's very poignant question, and if you see something going on, and if you see something, say something, or as you so aptly put, our parents to meddling, which seems like a contradictory statement. The answer, by the way, is yes. Next question. The parents are too involved very often. And then the second question that was being addressed was the divorce rate and the concern about the divorce rate. And, you know, why is it going up so much? Why is it escalating this generation so much? So I'm going to combine those two. I agree completely that what premarital counseling very often helps young couples do is to learn that behind the top things that young couples fight with, and what's interesting is that in every segment of society, you know, I work with all the range from the Hasidim and modern people and secular and non-Jewish and, you know, every type of person. But one of the things that I see is that the topics that people fight about are the same, because most of the things that young people fight about are young couples. They have subtext, you know, money has so much subtext to it. In-laws, you know, division of labor, like, do you respect me? Do you listen to my voice? You know, there's so much subtext there. So one of the things that premarital counseling does is it helps young couples learn productive conflict, where they're not just escalating through this revolving door where they have the same dance every time something triggers them, whether it's money or in-laws, because, you know, we're bringing a lot of life experiences to our marriage, many of them painful ones, and these triggers are there, and then they get stuck in this revolving door, the same fight over and over, over the many years. And in fact, you mentioned John Gottman, his research that followed couples for 32 years, found that couples would fight about the same issue year after year, these inevitable battles year after year of unresolvable issues, the same meddling in-laws, the same difficult child. But what they found is that couples who learned how to live with these issues in a healthy way, that had productive conflicts, didn't wear themselves out and wear each other out, wear their marriage out. And couples that would just become destructive in their fighting, they were the ones who really ended up getting divorced. So I do agree that learning how to have productive conflict and tools to calm yourself down, how to speak about it without getting destructive in your relationship is very, very important. And with regard in terms of like just basic guidelines for parents and in-laws, in terms of seeing a problem that's in a marriage or a concern that's in your child's marriage, there's nothing wrong with taking your child aside and saying, is everything okay? Checking in, offering to, if they think that they want to speak to someone professionally, to even help that and encourage that. But you can never pull them in and say, I'm very concerned about something your spouse is doing, because I guarantee you the next night that spouse will hear them, or when they're in a fight, they'll say, even my mother noticed, or even my father noticed. And you have many years that you have built a relationship with your child. So even if you say something that hurts them or that angers them, there are millions of moments that you have nurtured them and balanced that out. It goes into their memory bank, or even if they don't remember it, it goes down into their kishkas where emotions are formed, and it can repair itself, even if you say something that hurts them. But if you get involved directly with your child and mom in that kind of confrontation, they don't have those millions of moments, those serendipitous moments of love and nurturing. They don't have that biological loyalty to you. And you may have won the battle in that it'll get them to stop doing that one thing or to do that one thing you want them to do, but you've lost the war because your relationship with them will be damaged. So you really have to proceed with caution when you notice something and maybe just offering your child, if they're feeling concerned about it, to get the help outside, but not to get involved directly.
I'll offer just one final thought on that question before we move to our final question. And really, again, it overlaps with much of what Rabbi Leibowitz and Professor Klapper were saying. But I would say the following. I think one of the ironies, not just pertaining to marriage, but in many other areas of life as well, is that if we were asked to identify the central or most important parts of our lives, we would make a list. And then if we were asked to make an alternate list of what we spend the most time on, It's ironically doesn't really match up. We spend so much time on lots of things in our lives that aren't necessarily the things that we would identify as most important. And I think if we were asked, where do our spousal relationships rank on our significance or importance list in our hierarchy of values, it would probably be ranked pretty high. But how much time do we actively invest in actively pursuing the improvement of those relationships and actively investing in studying them and thinking about them and exercising better practices and trying to improve? I'll be the third person up here to mention Dr. Gottman. I always recommend to my chassanim, there's a book that he wrote, it's a New York Times bestseller. It's hardly like an erudite work of scholarship. It's a very accessible book called Seven Principles to Making Marriage Work. And I tell all of my chassanim that they should read it before they get married. You have to pass a road test in order to drive. You need all sorts of study and certification in order to engage in all sorts of different capacities and jobs in this world. And yet, to get married, you don't. But you should. And I think it's just very much worth that investment. And from a parental standpoint, I think this also largely overlaps with what Rabbi Leibowitz and Professor Clapper were both saying. I think at times you need to be very careful about the balance that we were describing in terms of getting too involved, but also trying to steer in the right direction. And at times, perhaps the best approach is rather than just overtly pressing yourself into a situation and trying to solve it, is gently encouraging children to seek the help that they actually need, perhaps from a third party. Rabbi Leibowitz mentioned before that there are so many tragic circumstances that I've dealt with where a couple comes to me and they're on the verge of divorce, their marriage has collapsed, and you ask them, what are the issues? And all the issues that they described are standard young couple issues. Standard just shana rishona, communication issues, whatever the issues may be, very solvable issues that have just exacerbated and metastasized and grown out of control to a point where perhaps the marriage is sellable with lots of very difficult and hard work, and sometimes it's not. I've seen cases where marriages have fallen apart over those things. And sometimes it's just chaval, it's almost such a shame, it's such a tragedy, that had they come 6 months earlier and they gotten the right help, the right outside help, really a marriage could have been saved and could have in theory been a very, very strong and healthy and joyous marriage as well. So at times, it's not necessarily inserting yourself, but perhaps, again, gently and carefully, maybe encouraging children to seek the outside help that they need that can perhaps really make a dramatic difference in a relationship and in a marriage. I'm going to pose one final question, and that is this. I'd like to ask each of the panelists, if they were to impart to the parents in the room a single concept, message, or idea that is important to share with their children about dating or marriage, what message would you share?
So I'll just say what I said before. Pay attention to how you feel. Don't only pay attention to whatever hashkafic issues or even tznius issues. I'm a big believer in tznius and everything, but pay attention to how you feel. Pay attention to how you're getting along, how easygoing you are, how easygoing the other person is, how positive you feel when you're together. And just from a parent perspective, be positive about that relationship. Once the relationship is there, highlight all the positive qualities of the person that they have chosen, and your positivity will only help that relationship.
This is a rare opportunity to help give parents messages and tools that could help their children. Usually you have young people coming sometimes in great distress, or you have parents in distress, and as a therapist, this is like an amazing opportunity to say, well, you know, working backwards, seeing what's going on with the kids during their dating, what tools do you think parents could be giving their kids or teaching their kids? So I'm not going to give you 40, I'm just going to give you 4 short ones to think of. The first is that all relationships, as Mindy so aptly mentioned, need flexibility. And we know that because most people here have really had, you know, a long-term, they're like deep roots, a long-term marriage, and they've learned to be flexible, and even if there's an occasional storm, you know, the roots are deep. But young couples, they're young saplings with very short roots. And if there's a lot of rigidity, you know, one storm can just blow them over. The image I think of is I drive every day over the Jerusalem Bridge to Bridge to go to my office. And sometimes when it's windy, that bridge is a very scary place because it's moving. But the movement actually prevents it from snapping, we hope. So the same is true of relationships when a young person is married to another young person. They're coming from a totally different culture. If it's, even if it's the same culture, each family is its own subculture. My children marry people really from different cultures. One is Israeli and one is Sephardi. But really, even if it's like another Tina family, it's still a different culture. Every family has a different way of resolving issues and a different level of respect versus kidding around. And it's a different way of conflict. And it's very important that you teach the children the flexibility and the adaptability. And if you're modeling very judgy behavior, that is something that they're going to take with them into a relationship. The second one is that before beginning the process of dating, I think it's a good idea for you to encourage your child to really think about and have a good sense of who they are, what their priorities are, what their values are. Adults go through a process. In psychology, this is a fancy term for everything, but it's a term for things we already know. So it's called the individualization, where you sort of separate from your parents and you try and establish your adult identity. And sometimes for a parent, this can be a little hurtful because their separation from you makes them sometimes different than you. Sometimes you maybe feel a little bit judged by them. And in the firm world, where people get married very young, sometimes they're going through the same process of separating from you and establishing their adult identity, what their values are, what their needs are, what their direction of their life is. That's different than yours at the time that they're dating. So you sort of feel like they're pulling away from you, going to them, it becomes very triggering, right? But I do think that if a person sits down honestly and thinks about what their basic needs are, not wants, because the lists are endless for the wants, but the real basic needs, like if they're an even-filled person who gets upset when people yell, and they're dating someone very dramatic and exciting, but they're dramatic when they're angry also, you know, what's that going to feel like for them? Is it going to give them an ulcer in their marriage, even if it's exciting when they're dating? So to really have a good sense of themselves and to start to really think about that seriously. And the third, and this is a very interesting topic with parents and children, because I know parents and children's criteria for dating is sometimes very different. But if you think about the criteria and you speak about it for your children, really try and stay focused on character traits, right? Not on professions, and not on what they wear on their head, and not on who their grandparent is, but really on the character traits, because there are things that change over life. What they wear, they're wearing a hat now, and they'll be wearing for 20 years in Israel. Who knows, but they're going to be wearing on their head in 20 years in their community. But the character traits, if they're open-minded, if they're optimistic, if they're intelligent, or if they're not, those are things that don't change. And I find a lot of times when people come to me and their criteria is very circumstantial and situational and really not broad enough to try and teach them to zoom out and think about character traits that don't change over time, not the things that do change over time, like their interests, like are the same as your interests. You both like hockey, that may or not change over time. Anyone who loves hockey here will think it doesn't change, but it may change. And then the last thing is, and this is an important tool, is some children have been modeled productive conflict from their parents, and I see that their parents have modeled for them this amazing giving ability. And they go into marriage like a duck in water. They go into marriage with this expectation, as Gottman, since everyone's mentioned Gottman in his books, Gottman wrote in his book called Bad Dates, he says couples don't have an unrealistic expectation that it should be 50-50. But really in marriage, it needs to be 100% in. 100 and 100. That if someone goes in with 50-50, invariably, they're going to start keeping score and looking for equity and being disappointed. Because there's no way it can be equal. How many dirty diapers equals me relocating for your career? Like, how can it be equal? And even if you try and make it tit for tat at the beginning of your marriage, over the many years of a marriage, we've all seen couples where one's health fails and the other couple has to do everything for them, and hopefully they had a long life together, but there's no equity, you know, in a marriage. It has to be like you're 100% in. So couples who see that modeled for them do have a little bit of an unfair advantage because they go in with an expectation expectation of it's going to be communal, and it's going to be whatever is good for the family is good for me. But even if you don't know the kind of exact model, they confirm that, and describing that expectation for them really helps the young couple. Describing that, if you, you know, when you walk into a relationship, it should be like the love of a mother and a child, a mother and a baby, or a father and a baby. Doesn't look at their baby and say, what am I getting out of this? This baby only burps and they only poop, and it's like, well, what's this about? You know, they look at the baby and it's just, they're all in. You know, they're all in. And having that expectation of being all in is a very important expectation for children when they go into the marriage. A lot of talk briefly about divorce, but a lot of the research shows that this new chapter in people's life, they're really looking for equity in relationships. And not into this, this, you know, what we're going to be able to give for the person, the expectation that we give more than we even receive. And the last tool of productive conflict, again, some people see a model, but if they don't, they can still learn that. That is a learnable skill and a very important skill for their life.
Thank you. I'm going to get you up the way. We've been discussing how dating and marriage is difficult. And sometimes we see this a lot in our office, and Efrat always reminds me that all worthwhile things come with hard work, and marriage is beautiful, as you all know. So that's the most important message to remember. It is hard, it takes a lot of work, but everything that is worthwhile takes a lot of effort, and it is beautiful.
She meant that we should tell this to our kids.
I want to thank all of our panelists. We are already over time. I'm going to audaciously take 2 more minutes of your time and say the following. YU Connects is going to be doing a fundraiser soon, and this is an organization that deserves our support. I think there is an ironic paradox with the way many of us approach the realm of Shidduchim, where on the one hand, we do recognize that it is one of the most important things, or if not the single most important thing in terms of our communal continuity, in terms of the future of Klal Yisrael. And I constantly have conversations with people about what more we can be doing, and hopefully all of us are doing our part. Just today, I had a conversation with Rina and with my brother about some shidduchim that we are considering. I'm not a particularly successful shatran, but I am an earnest one, and I try to do my own part. And yet, on the other hand, we tend to take the people who do this professionally and extraordinarily earnestly and invest immense amounts of time and effort into these initiatives for granted. And we can't take them for granted. It's just wrong to take them for granted, and we don't have the luxury of taking them for granted. We just can't afford it. So I urge everybody to please support organizations like YU Connects when they have their fundraiser soon. I plan on donating personally. I strongly encourage you to do so as well. And please let us all make sure to do our own part in order to secure the future of Klal Yisrael. I encourage everybody to enjoy the refreshments that are on the other side of the room. I want to thank all of our sponsors and thank all of you for joining us tonight.